Forward on
Yeah.
And I also thought hearing in the health and the health.
The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We are going to resume with the continuation of the discussion of the forecasted programs. And we're going to have Katie Burns back up at the table. And you, if you saved it from yesterday, you should have the packet that looks like this. We'll be working on it.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Yesterday, we had gotten through the overview portion of the presentation and continuing care, and so I think we'll pick back up with basic health care costs
right.
This morning.
It's a page that's about two-thirds of the way through, maybe.
And so it starts off, if your version of slides are numbered, it's slide number 11, and it starts off with a bar graph. They are not numbered. Okay,
no,
nothing
no.
so convenient for you as that. My apologies.
Basic health care is the title.
And the bar graph shows projected general fund and health care access fund spending in the current biennium with estimates for fiscal year 2008 and 9. Across the four basic health care programs. And those are, of course, medical assistance for families and children, medical assistance for elderly and disabled, general assistance medical care, and Minnesota care. And across these four basic health care programs, spending is projected to grow by almost $900 million between the current biennium and fiscal year 2008 and 9, or 22%. If we wanted to look at that on an average annual growth basis from fiscal year 2006 to 2009, that average annual growth rate is 10.5%. In terms of the individual programs, MA Families and Children is projected to grow by $283 million, or 22.7%, between the two biennia, and that's an annual average growth rate of 11.4%. So again, two different comparison points about how to think about growth in the program. In the MA Elderly and Disabled segment, spending is projected to grow by $453 million, or 27%. That's an average annual growth rate of 12.6%. I do want to point out that part of that growth is attributable to some spending for elderly waiver that's now paid for through managed care being accounted for in this part of the budget as opposed to the waiver activity. So this isn't all new program growth. Some of it is just a question of what part of the budget in which this is being paid for. GAMC is slated to do to.
Could you just stop for a minute? We have just a little bit of a question here. If the MA Elderly and Disabled Program is growing by 27% over a four-year period, how can it be growing by 12% per year?
It's an annual average growth rate. So the first comparison is a looking at fiscal year 2006 and 7 spending versus projections for 2008 and 9, and then the average annual growth rate measures, it's not just cutting that in half, it's taking it's looking at growth from fiscal year 2006 to 2009 and assessing the average annual growth over that time period.
Okay, so it would be smaller if you did it just for the first year of that time period, and larger than that for the last year of that time period. And so what you're doing is averaging it over those 4 years per year?
Chair, I'm not sure that's accurate. George, could you?
One, 12, what? I'm sorry.
We were talking about, the chair's question was about
the
MA
annual average is 12 point what?
12.6 for MA.
12.6 versus a 27% average annual. Or, excuse me, biennial growth.
Okay, 27% biennium over biennium, 12.5% per year for the change from 06 to 07 to 08 to 09. Now, the biennial change is approximately twice the average annual change. But the biennial change will be different depending on where the growth fell among
right.
those
That's
years,
kind of what
7,
I was
8,
saying.
And 9.
I was saying it could be a lot lower in the first year and a lot higher in the last year, but when you do it on an average over each year, then the number might not be the same cut in half.
It's a distributional issue between
right.
the biennial view and the annual view. And so they can be different. They're approximately twice. A biennial growth rate is approximately a two-year growth rate. And I always remind people that because we talk about 20%, 20-some percent biennium over biennium, and people tend to compare that to an annual growth rate. And
right.
they say, oh, that's awful high. Well, it's 2 years' worth of growth. And so you've got to think about it roughly halved, but an actual calculation of annual growth rate will give you a somewhat different figure.
So I think that's kind of what I just said.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm agreeing with
my layman's version of it, okay? Thank you very much. Why don't we go on then?
Thank you. In GAMC, spending is projected to decline by $110 million, or 19.3% between the two biennia. That's an average annual decline of 6.7%. We want to be clear that much of this is due to GAMC enrollees shifting to Minnesota Care, or a good portion of GAMC enrollees shifting to Minnesota Care starting in fiscal year 2007. So this is not reflective of a projected decline in program demand, rather a question of where these folks would be served. In Minnesota Care, spending is projected to grow by $271 million, or 49.1% from fiscal year 2006 and 7 to 2008 and 9. That's an average annual growth rate of 17.7%, and there's a lot of activity that folks have heard about over the past couple of weeks in terms of new groups of enrollees shifting into Minnesota Care and some enrollees shifting out of Minnesota Care, and so all of that is embedded in that growth figure. So again, we've got a good portion of GAMC enrollees moving into Minnesota Care, and that's going to be offset somewhat by a projected movement of MA or of families moving into MA families with children because of Health Match that I know you've heard and talked about.
Any other questions on this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Okay, similar to what we did with continuing care yesterday, we're going to look at average monthly enrollment trends in each of the basic health care programs, and we'll do that from fiscal years 1997 through fiscal year 2006, and fiscal year 2006, of course, is the fiscal year for which we have complete data, the most recent fiscal year that we have complete data. And across the four basic care programs, enrollment increased roughly 123,000, an annual average change of 2.2% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. And you can see the trend lines look quite different among these four programs. MA families and kids enrollment fluctuated significantly over the past 9 years. On net, enrollment increased by almost 53,000 on an average monthly basis between fiscal years 1997 and 2006, or an annual average increase of 1.8%. A number of things contributed to the ups and downs in this trend line. I would point out that expansion of income eligibility guidelines contributed to the growth in fiscal years 2002 and 2003. In terms of the MA elderly and disabled segment, enrollment increased roughly 34,000 between fiscal years 1997 to 2006, and that's an annual average increase of 2.9%. elderly enrollment is driven by the number of elderly persons needing long-term care services. About two-thirds of our MA elderly and disabled enrollees receive either nursing facility or elderly waiver services. Disabled enrollment is driven largely by the number of state and federal disability determinations. In Minnesota Care, again, a varied story there. Minnesota Care enrollment grew steadily from fiscal year 1997 through fiscal year 2003 and subsequently declined starting in fiscal year 2004. I know the committee had an opportunity to talk about that some last week. That decline resulted from significant program changes as well as an applications processing backlog. On net, enrollment grew by almost 36,000 between fiscal years 1997 and 2006, an annual average change of 3.6%. And then in looking ahead a bit in Minnesota Care, the projected increase in enrollment starting in fiscal year 2007 is largely attributable to the GAMC folks moving into Minnesota Care. So again, want to be clear that, this is a new population of folks being served in Minnesota Care. And then the projected decline in 08 and 09 is partially attributable to the health match shift of families to the MA program for families and children.
Senator Laurie, did you have a question?
I was going to ask about the decline forecasted beginning in 2008 and 2009. It's you're projecting that these families are going to be Medicaid at that time?
This is related to the issue that you talked about last week, related to the new health match eligibility determination system that will help point eligible families to the program that is most advantageous to them, and when we assume that system will be up and ready to go. I don't know, George, if you'd add anything.
We're forecasting that about 40,000 enrollees will move out of Minnesota Care and into medical assistance. So that's a factor in the growth in medical assistance in fiscal 09 and 10, and it's a factor in the decrease in Minnesota Care. And the total movement between those two programs is about 40,000.
Okay. We might not have time to go into all that's behind that right now, but just intuitively to me, that seems pretty high for the Medicaid eligibility. I don't know. Maybe the outreach isn't as good as I've thought.
Senator Laurie, I think part of the reason that people have been in Minnesota Care when they might be better off being in medical assistance is because they haven't had to go to their local county social service office to apply for Minnesota Care. They can apply over the phone directly to the state. And so then that's viewed by them as being, you know, more like an insurance program that they're enrolling in.
Well, this will be great if we can get this done. I just hope it's not overly optimistic. And so would like to see at some point some of the numbers backing up those projections.
Well, we're all waiting for Health Match to happen,
yep.
That's
yep.
For sure. But the Health Match program will tell them that they could have, a similar benefit or even maybe in some cases a little bit better benefit and not have to pay a premium. And so the assumption is then that many families would take that opportunity. They don't necessarily have to go into their county social services office to find that out.
Great.
Other questions on this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Okay. The next slide looks at GAMC, average monthly enrollment, and we just pulled this program out to look at separately simply because the trend line was impossible to pick up on the prior slide. And as you can see, GAMC enrollment fluctuated significantly over the past 9 years, falling in the late 1990s during an economic expansion and rising in the early part of this decade. Policy changes enacted in fiscal year 2004 caused enrollment to decline in that year. And again, the forecasted enrollment decreases starting in fiscal year 2007 are the result of GAMC folks being served in Minnesota Care, or many of them. Okay, we wanted to also talk about average cost trends in basic health care programs. And by way of background on average costs, it's helpful to have a sense of the proportion of basic health care enrollees whose care is paid for under managed care payment arrangements. And as this slide demonstrates, most of our basic health care enrollees participate in managed care. 77% of MA families with children, 79% of MA elderly, 72% of GAMC, more than 95% of our Minnesota care enrollees, and then fewer than 1% of the MA disabled population. Because such a high proportion of our enrollees participate in managed care, average payments are affected primarily by the rates that we pay to the health plans that contract with us and the mix of higher and lower cost or lower rate enrollees in the program. Another key component to understand here is that under federal law, managed care rates are required to be actuarially sound, and that's a fundamental issue in how we set rates annually with our health plans. I'm just going to keep on moving here unless folks have questions for me. So the next slide talks about average monthly payments in each of the basic health care programs. And MA family average payments increased by an annual average rate of 6.8% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. MA elderly and disabled average monthly payments, increased by an annual average rate of 7.1% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. You'll see in fiscal year 2007, there's a dip in this line, and that's resulting from pharmacy costs shifting to Medicare Part D. In GAMC, the average payment increased at an annual average rate of 7.7% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. And in Minnesota Care, average monthly payments increased at an annual average rate of 13.9% over that nine-year period.
Questions? Let's keep going then.
That takes us through the basic health care portion of the presentation, and we move on to the third and final area that we'll talk about today, and that's Children and Family Services forecast programs. And you'll see from the bar graph that there are five programs included as or considered forecast programs within this business area of the department, and that's the MFIP program, MFIP and Transitional Year Child Care, General Assistance, Group Residential Housing, and Minnesota Supplemental Aid. Across all Children and Family Services forecast programs, all fund spending, and I want to be clear that this is the general fund, TANF, and the Child Care and Development Fund spending. The all fund spending is projected to increase by $57 million or 5.5% between this biennium and fiscal year 2008 and 9. This is an annual average increase of 2.8% between fiscal years 2006 and 2009. In terms of spending trends in the individual programs, for the MFIP program, projections are that spending will decline by $1 million or 0.2% between this biennium and the next. In the MFIP and Transition Year Child Care Assistance Program, spending is projected to increase by $22 million or 10.4% on a biennial basis. That's an average annual increase of 5.6%. In general assistance, spending is projected to increase by $8 million or 11.8% between this and the next biennium. That's an average annual change of 6.9%. In group residential housing, projected spending is estimated to increase by $27 million or 16.7% between biennia, and that's an average annual change of 8.2%. And then in MSA, spending is projected to increase by $1 million or 1.7% between biennia.
Kind of makes the word investment in Minnesota Family Investment Program an oxymoron, doesn't it? Any questions on this page? Let's go on then.
Okay. This next slide looks at average monthly caseload trends in the MFIP program, as well as MFIP and transition year child care. I want to be clear that this represents families and cases, not individual numbers of people. In the MFIP program, we see that from where this chart picks up in fiscal year 1999, that caseloads declined as welfare reform was implemented and a strong economy provided ample employment opportunities. Caseloads began to increase in fiscal year 2002 and began to decline again in fiscal year 2004. Overall, average monthly cases declined by approximately 7,200 between fiscal years 1999 and 2006, an average annual decline of 2.5%. This caseload decline is projected to continue, though at a slower rate over the forecast horizon. And then you can also see the lower line on the graph reflects participation in MFIP and transition year child care. And you can see that caseloads there have fluctuated over time, reaching a high point in fiscal year 2003. Participation declined by roughly 1,500 average monthly families, or an average annual decline of 2.4% between fiscal years 1999 and 2006.
Why don't we keep going?
And then we're going to look at average monthly payments per case or per family again. And you can see that in the higher line here is the MFIP transition year child care program. And you can see that average payments have fluctuated over time, and that's because of numerous changes in how maximum rates are set for providers in that program. I'm going to give you a simplified explanation of what's happened to the setting of provider rates over the past few years, just to give you a sense of why this has jumped around. But prior to the fiscal year 2004 and 5 biennium, maximum provider rates were based on market rate surveys and set at the 75th percentile of those market rate surveys. In fiscal year 2004, maximum rates were frozen through the end of fiscal year 2005 initially, and then through subsequent legislation, that maximum rate freeze stayed in place for most providers through the end of calendar year 2005. Maximum rates were increased beginning in fiscal year, in January 1st, 2006, and then increased again on July 1st of 2006. So there has been quite a bit of movement in that program in terms of rate setting. From fiscal years 1999 through 2006, average monthly payments increased by an annual average growth rate of 4.8%. Alternatively, monthly average payments to families participating in the MFIP cash and food program have remained relatively stable over time. Marginal changes in payment levels are likely attributable to policy changes enacted in fiscal years 2004 and 5, which required budgeting a portion of SSI and subsidized housing benefits against the MFIP grant.
Let's keep going.
The next slide just looks at general assistance enrollment, and there we see from fiscal years 1997 to 2000, GA average monthly caseloads declined due to robust economic circumstances and began to increase again in fiscal year 2001 after economic growth stalled. From fiscal years 2001 to 2006, average monthly enrollment increased by an annual average of 11.9%.
Let's keep going.
Okay. We have two more slides for you today, and they both deal with MSA and group residential housing. The first looks at enrollment trends, and the second at average payments in both programs. From fiscal years 1997 to fiscal year 2006, participation in MSA grew by an annual average of 1.9%, and GRH enrollment grew by an annual average of 5%. Federal SSI determinations drive Minnesota supplemental aid enrollment, while GRH participation is driven by county-approved placements in those settings.
Keep going.
Okay. And our last slide looks at average payments in GA, MSA, and GRH. And as you can see, monthly average payments have remained steady over time for MSA recipients, while payment levels have fluctuated in GRH and general assistance. Just want to point out that the drop in GA payments that occurred in fiscal year 2001 occurred because a component of the program that used to make facility-based payments to battered women's shelters through GA was transferred to the Department of Corrections as a capped grant program, and that dropped our average payments significantly. So just wanted to explain what was happening there, and there are no more facility-based payments in the general assistance program. So these reflect just payments to cases. And so from fiscal years 1997 to fiscal year 2006, in the GRH program, payments rose by an annual average rate of 0.5%.
Any questions for Katie? Now, thank you very much for your very nice presentation.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it. And we'll be anxiously awaiting whatever changes will be coming our way. Now we're going to turn to the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Human Services, and we'll begin by hearing from Christine Bronson, the deputy commissioner.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Christine Bronson, deputy commissioner of the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to begin with some overview comments about the governor's budget and then talk through two agency-wide budget proposal change pages that affect my area.
Okay. You want to just tell us when you start on a page what page you're on?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair. The governor's proposed budget for 2008-2009 biennium makes significant investments in human services while maximizing value. This budget furthers our mission to help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. To accomplish this, the governor proposes expenditures of $22.2 billion, $9.3 billion from the state's general fund and $12.9 billion from other funds. The budget proposals for human services represent a 14.4% increase from 06-07 all funds spending. This is the result of both proposed new investments and forecasted growth in existing programs under current law. Growth in utilization and cost of services, as well as increased enrollment of approximately 17,000 participants, account for this increase. These factors alone will increase spending by $1 billion from the previous biennium. Strategic new investments for the coming biennium include a health reform effort that addresses quality, access, and cost, and an initiative that improves the mental health system so people get more effective care. As you know, the governor has proposed a multi-agency initiative called Healthy Connections. The proposal will bring new value to our healthcare system by emphasizing quality and affordability in both the private sector and public programs. Commissioner Osberg will talk through the budget page with you sometime later today. A second key investment is in mental health. The governor's mental health initiative invests $45 million to improve the mental health care system, better aligning acute care and mental health care to achieve more effective outcomes for individuals. The proposal is based on the recommendations of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, or MHAG, as many of you know it, a group of stakeholders and policymakers that identified concrete steps for improving the mental health system. Overall, the governor's budget proposals for human services emphasize quality and value. The budget proposal includes payments that reward high-quality child care, optimal health care, and support high-quality nursing home care. The budget also advances DHS priorities to help vulnerable children, the elderly, and the homeless. The budget increases funding for adoption assistance, improves help to the elderly to make informed choices about safe living arrangements, and provides funding for people who are homeless through increased supportive housing funds. The governor's budget also helps to address, in the short term, the significant anticipated loss of federal funding supporting core case management services for vulnerable populations that are currently performed by county agencies. Together, this package of proposals will continue Minnesota's strong tradition of providing help at times of need with an emphasis on quality and value.
Why don't you start your overview then?
Very good. Madam Chair and members, there are two change items in the governor's budget that I'm going to review with you. They are the last two items of your white pages, beginning on page 232. The title of page 232 is entitled TANF Refinancing. Many of you know that TANF, which stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is Minnesota's block grant from the federal government to run our MFIT program and other activities that provide economic supports to poor families in Minnesota. All TANF funds must be spent on federally defined purposes, and such expenditures must be documented. In addition, Minnesota is required to continue a maintenance of effort investment, or MOE investment, of $170 million a year in state-only investments in eligible activities for poor families. The TANF fund and TANF MOE investments are tracked separately from the general fund. Throughout the budget process, when you receive a budget tracking document for the general fund, you will separately receive a one-page TANF fund balance and a one-page healthcare access fund balance. This change page, while not making any programmatic changes, is necessary to properly document which Minnesota programs and investments, be they cash grants, child care, or tax credits, are funded out of which of three funds, the general fund, TANF, or TANF MOE. The governor's budget recommends that child care, currently funded with general fund TANF MOE dollars, now be funded with TANF dollars, and that the existing working family credit funded with general fund dollars be counted as TANF MOE. This page has the effect of properly documenting the use of all funds for eligible purposes and supports the state's economic assistance programs as they are proposed in the governor's budget.
So, Ms. Bronson, what happens if we don't do this page?
Madam Chair, this page is necessary to support the governor's proposals. If you did no TANF refinancing, the legislature would not need this page.
So it's not necessary to document anything, really. It's necessary if you think you don't have enough general fund money to spend.
Madam Chair, this page does use general fund dollars for human services investments, and it's been a common practice of the legislature over the last at least 7 years to use resources to fund programs that are the priority of either the governor in his proposal or the legislature's priorities in their final bill.
So because we've done a terrible thing for 7 years, we should keep doing it.
Madam Chair, it's at your discretion what the final bill will look like.
Any other questions on this page?
The second change page I will direct your attention to is found on page 234, and it is entitled Compensation Adjustment. This page outlines the governor's proposal to provide a 2% per year rate increase to DHS staff. This increase mitigates typical and existing increases in costs, including pension obligations, projected health insurance increases, and costs of steps and progressions that are part of existing bargaining agreements. It also sets the parameters for any increases that might be negotiated in the coming year's labor negotiations. Other committees will review similar budget pages for the respective agencies that they oversee. This page also requests a 3.25% per year increase for specialized direct care services performed by specific DHS staff. This increase applies to those staff working at the state's regional treatment centers and for secure programs such as the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, MEDO, and the Mentally Ill and Dangerous Program. It does not include any state-provided direct care services that are run on an enterprise basis. You will see governor-recommended requests at this level for two other state-provided services in other committees, one request for the Department of Corrections and the other for the State Patrol at the Department of Public Safety.
Ms. Branson, was there anything provided by way of a cost of living increase for the county programs that really run our TANF program?
Madam Chair, I would have to defer to staff about the TANF program.
I assume this 2% includes the department's TANF staff.
That's correct. It would include all staff at the Department of Human Services, including Commissioner Johnson's staff in economic assistance programs.
But I don't believe it includes anything for the county administered part of the program. And I don't believe we've ever given a COLA for the county administered part of this program.
Madam Chair, the state's general fund budget is not the payment source for county staff. So county boards would set what those increases would or wouldn't be.
But isn't it just the same as it would be for the department? If we don't give your TANF staff a COLA, then you have to absorb that by reducing your complement. And isn't that the same for the counties then when we're, at the ground level, they actually deliver services, so if they have increases, they have to absorb those by reducing the services they provide.
Certainly, Madam Chair, it's the responsibility of the agency, or in this case, the county agency and county commissioners, to manage an administrative budget for their staff.
And what was the COLA that was given in the governor's budget for the long-term care 24-hour, 7-days-a-week services that we provide through our contracted nursing homes?
Madam Chair, the governor's budget proposes a 2% rate increase to nursing homes each year.
But for our 24/7 operations, the proposal is a 3.25% per year increase.
Madam Chair, the 3.25% increase in the governor's budget is solely for those facilities that are either regional treatment centers or have secure and highly specialized performance requirements. This 3.25% does not apply to any of our enterprise state-operated services, group homes, and that sort of thing.
Right, but it does apply, for instance, to the veterans nursing homes that are run by the state. It does apply to our regional treatment centers that are run by the state, where we have long-term care workers working directly for the state.
Madam Chair, it would apply to our sex offender treatment program, our forensics nursing home programs. I would need to check with staff about whether or not this would apply to veterans homes nursing staff. It's not my understanding that it does. We can get back to you on that.
Well, I just find it a little troubling that it's so much easier to give less than what we think is needed for those providing services because we contract with them, as opposed to those who are providing services directly by receiving a payroll check from the state.
Madam Chair, there is a history of COLAs in the back of your budget book, if you'd like me to direct your attention there. It's in the green pages towards the end, and it can show the COLA history for direct care providers who we do contract with. The agency's administrative budget increase history is much different than that page. As you know, the agency has absorbed significant administrative decreases over the last several years since 2002. So in that respect, direct care providers that have received increases, even modest increases, over the last 4 or 5 years are in a different position than the agency currently is.
Any other questions about this page? Go ahead, ma'am.
Next.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Coleman is prepared to walk through the continuing care change pages in the governor's budget.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I have one question. I'm a little slow on the draw this morning. I have one question for the Deputy Commissioner. Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, I did get a request to ask about this. I believe it comes under your purview. It's a disability linkage line. It's an item that has been funded in the last number of years, and its funding for it is going to be ending on June 30th.
I think that would be under Assistant Commissioner Coleman's.
Okay, I'll save my question.
So,
thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at the Department for Continuing Care. If you'd like me to address that question before I begin the change pages, I'll
that would be fine.
Do so. The current funding for the disability linkage line, which was initiated under a federal grant to develop this support, does expire June 30th, 2007. We are working internally to try and identify efficiencies and resources that would be able to support information and assistance to people with disabilities. But at this point in time, we have not concluded that assessment, nor do I want to mislead the committee that we will be able to continue it in the full scope that it currently exists. It is an important program, and we recognize that, and we're making attempts to try to solve around the lack of funding for this program.
Follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So since it's not in the governor's budget at this point and the federal dollars supporting this program ends in June, although you're trying to look around and find some additional money, is there any future for the disability linkage line in your perspective or in terms of the governor's budget? And then how is that related to the senior linkage line? Because that also, I believe, is supported by federal dollars.
Madam
Assistant
Chair,
Commissioner.
Senator Erickson Ropes. The linkage lines are part of a broad strategy to provide information and assistance to both seniors and people with disabilities. We have been working together between the programs to try and achieve the efficiencies that would be able to support both of them. They're both challenged in funding. The linkage line for people with disabilities does require an additional base of knowledge that is specific to services for those supports, and again, we're trying to find ways to continue that support through either linkage line, MinnesotaHelp.info, etc. There are many competing programs for funding through both the governor's budget and the legislative budget that's assembled. And making those priority decisions is a difficult one. This one was not able to be included in the governor's budget, but that doesn't diminish the importance of it.
Okay, let's move on to your budget presentation then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll direct you to page 170, and we'll continue the discussion on long-term care payment adjustments, or COLAs, that some people want to refer to it. The governor has included in his budget that medical assistant payment rates for continuing care providers be increased by 2%, effective 10-1-07 and 7-1-08. The governor also recommends continuing the current policy of attributing a portion of the nursing facility's payment increase to performance measures. With a little more detail, the proposal would increase the rates for continuing care providers and certain grants for people who are elderly or or who have disabilities on 10-1 by 2%. The nursing facility component of the continuing care delivery system would increase 1.5% on 10-1-07, with the opportunity to receive an additional, on average, 0.5%. So it is 2 and 2. The 0.5% for nursing facilities would allow nursing facilities, based upon their quality score, to earn anywhere from 0 to an additional 1.2% in their rates. So to be a little more clear, because it gets confusing with the numbers, nursing facilities would receive anywhere from 1.5% to 2.7% based upon their quality score. The quality measures that have been developed for this program are a result of several years of work with stakeholders to develop the measures and develop the scoring mechanism for them. They are always subject to improvement. And the proposed quality measures for 10-1-07 are slightly different than those measures that were used for 10-1-06 distribution. The most notable change on the 10-1-07 quality scores are the inclusion of quality of life satisfaction surveys directly from residents that have now been completed through two cycles and will be beginning a third cycle shortly. We will also eliminate the staff turnover measurement because that was somewhat duplicative, although measured differently, from staff retention. So we retain staff retention, but we have eliminated staff turnover as a measure. And we have included staffing levels as a measure of quality based upon the nursing home report card that is a public document. These proposed measures have been shared with the stakeholders. They've been negotiated. They're fully aware of them, and we have worked at assigning the appropriate level of points to each of those six measures that will be used for the quality add-on on 2107, or 10-107. I'm sorry.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, this sounds good, but my concern is that the nursing homes already have been they've had insufficient funds to run adequately. They haven't had significant increases for a long time. They have had some increases in cost of living for the workers. But administrative costs, the cost of administration continues to rise, and there hasn't been support for that. I'm concerned that if we continue this process of rewarding those nursing homes that are doing better, that we are creating even more disparity. Some of them are not starting at a level playing field. Many of them are being paid at much lower rates than other nursing homes. And I'm concerned that if we now have this system of rewarding those who are able to staff higher because they have a higher payment rate, that we create more disparity and it's going to force nursing homes out of the market, especially in the rural areas where there aren't as many that we can afford to lose because they're sparse.
Senator Pretner-Solon, just so everyone on the committee knows, 25% of the COLA that was given over the last 2 years How can I say this? 25% of the part of the COLA that was given and allocated across the board was not dedicated toward wages or benefits. So the nursing homes could spend that on whatever other costs they had. In addition to that, the incentive payment was not required to be dedicated toward any particular thing. So the nursing homes could use that for whatever they wanted to use it for.
Madam Chair.
They got it.
Right.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, and that was a small amount. It was, wasn't it like 1.76% or?
It was 2.25%.
Okay.
And I think it was the 2.5% that was the add-on for the performance.
And Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize how these nursing homes are struggling, the long-term care facilities are struggling, and that when we create greater disparity, it makes it harder when it comes around to the survey process because they're then measured against places that are have the opportunity to be able to perform better than those that don't have sufficient funds to be able to function well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Coleman, I believe everybody around this table is greatly concerned about our nursing homes in our district. I have 14 of them. Not one of them is in the black. My question has to do with the scoring and kind of a several-part question. Your scoring measures really have nothing to do, the 0.5% really has nothing to do with the survey team that is coming in to survey the home. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is a component in the quality add-on measurement that is related to the federal state survey that is completed by the Minnesota Department of Health. But it's not a numerical component. It's not, well, you had 15 deficiencies, therefore you get this score. It is based upon those care items, and again, we've worked with stakeholders to try to identify which of the citations are truly representative of care deficiencies, and then you are also only penalized, so to speak, if there's a significant scope or severity to those deficiency findings. So it's not been a terribly controversial part of the scoring mechanism for the stakeholder group to this point in time.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I probably would agree with you. I think there's other little more contentious part of that survey, and as we all know, it's somewhat the luck of the draw what survey team these nursing homes get and how their report comes out. But what I would like to say, I think it maybe pertains more to Greater Minnesota, this scoring mechanism has been extremely onerous for a lot of nursing homes out in Greater Minnesota because their pool of employees is very small. It is very small. So they're eliminating the staff turnover was good, but now you include staffing levels, and that's even going to be more difficult for some of these homes. They don't have a large pool to pick from, and you add on what we're paying them. They are truly, again, doing this as a labor of love. So I'm a little concerned about them being able to get up to the 0.12% increase that they can get. That is a big, big difference if they can't reach the top level. That makes a big difference in their bottom line. And I know I'm going to be hearing from my nursing homes about this, and I already have, actually.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, just for background, we do have some history with this program and distributing the rate adjustment according to the quality measures. And for your information, 373 of the approximately 400 nursing homes in Minnesota receive some portion of the quality add-on 10106. Now, I will admit that some of it was on the low end, but the scoring mechanism is available to all facilities, and the far majority of the facilities receive something of the quality add-on from 10106.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I heard you say that these quality measurements were negotiated over a period of time, and I'm also representing a rural district that's main message is that the system for which they're reimbursed is unacceptable. They're not able to survive, and that this measurement looks to me as well that it really has a negative impact on the rural area. But and I'd like that to be communicated that I believe that this is not helpful for a rural part of the state that's already having disparity in terms of its reimbursement rates. So the second thing I would say is that I'm surprised that these are, of all the quality initiatives that you might be measuring, are the ones that were selected. I heard you say that these were negotiated with the stakeholders. But the quality initiatives that I think are more indicative of quality have to do with falls and have to do with bladder infections and have to do with bed sores and have to do with other kinds of medication errors that create increased costs in this healthcare system. So I don't know that you can speak to that, but I am curious to know why these, which do not really get at what's happening at the patient level that would reflect the need for increased funding for staff, are not the measurements that are being used. And I think in part it's because it would clearly communicate that we're underfunding in this system.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, let me expand a bit about one of the measures. One of the requirements of nursing facilities is to complete what's known as the minimum data set, the MDS. And that is a very comprehensive assessment of the needs of the individual patient and has an ongoing component of reportability. That is used to measure quality indicators. How well are facilities doing on some of the very specific clinical issues that you've identified, which are extremely important? And so their quality indicator score via the MDS is one of the measurements that is used to compute their quality add-on. So it may not have the weighting that, you know, everybody might want, but it is part of the component of measuring quality in a facility.
Assistant Commissioner, as we were discussing yesterday, we have more people being served in our home and community-based system now than we do in our institutional settings. And this COLA also is applied to those type of providers. But there is no incentive for quality in that part of the system. And I'm wondering if there's been thought given to that as well. I mean, the biggest complaint I hear from people is that somebody was supposed to show up and they didn't show up. And, you know, that can be quite serious in terms of affecting whether a person can stay in their home or whether they deteriorate or not.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, the concept of incenting quality for all continuing care providers is something that we're very interested in. There are obstacles, but they certainly can be overcome. One, we don't have a similar in the home and community-based setting, it can consist of multiple providers who are impacting the lives of the people that they're serving. and they can be interrelated in terms of how good a job they're doing. That's not an excuse for not doing it. I'm just saying it. I'm just trying to demonstrate it's more complicated to come up with the system that would reward the right things in the home and community-based service component. And we have not negotiated, we've not developed the quality measures as we have on the nursing facility side. Again, it's not impossible to do, but it's not a portion of the system that's been developed yet. But we certainly have had discussions, and we have great interest in getting to that type of feature on the home community-based side also when we're able to devote the resources to developing those measurements and implementing such a quality incentive. These components on the nursing facility side have literally taken a number of years to get to this point in time. It didn't happen in 1 or 2 years. It's been a multi-year initiative.
And the other thing I just like to mention to the members of the committee is that usually the home and community-based providers are paid even less than those in the nursing home. And most of the time they're not paid for their transportation, and they're not paid for the downtime of their transportation either. So we need to remember that when we hear from nursing homes about how hard it is for them. We need to remember the majority of our clients now are served in home and community-based settings, and that part of the system has even more problems in terms of reimbursement and retention of workers. Right. Let's move on then.
The next proposal in the governor's budget can be found on page 176. The governor is recommending effective 7107 that we require individual care plans in support of the elderly waiver funding for assisted living, and provide consumers who are considering moving to assisted living settings with information about in-home services. This proposal has several components. We know that assisted living is an extremely fast-growing product in the marketplace. It has captured the attention of the consumer, and decisions are being made based upon the information that's available. There are recent initiatives to provide more consumer information. And again, working with stakeholders, we've been working on that type of approach. But we don't know all that we need to know about assisted living and how consumers are making that choice. So first of all, we are proposing a study that would examine how particularly private pay consumers are making that selection, making that choice, and how that may be a contributing factor to earlier impoverishment or earlier need for public programs. We just don't know enough about the marketplace and the consumer needs at this point in time. We're also proposing that we provide additional information and support to consumers prior to or while they are considering moving into an assisted living setting. And so we are proposing to expand the long-term care consultation program to also be required for those individuals or available for those individuals who are moving into assisted living. For those who are not familiar, this is a policy, a long-standing policy of the state to require all individuals who are moving into a nursing facility to receive a long-term care consultation, to provide that kind of information that validates that the choice that they are making to move into a nursing facility is the best option for them. We're applying that same principle to those individuals who are considering assisted living. It is not a binding decision. In other words, it's information. It doesn't restrict a consumer from making a choice to move into assisted living, but it does help them understand what other services may be available to help them remain in their homes. So we're treating the consumer similarly, both for the nursing facility product as well as for the assisted living product. Additionally, this would create a website on MinnesotaHealth.info about assisted living, and that is a project that we are co-managing with the Minnesota Department of Health. One last component on this page would be to revise the manner in which we look at supervision for elderly waiver in assisted living. The level of supervision is driven by the needs of the individual, an assessment of the individual. But the rates that are associated with assisted living supervision is dominated by 24-hour supervision. And so what we are proposing is that we develop a more specific measurement that would indicate the specific needs of the individual need for supervision. Could be a tiered approach, 1 to 4 hours, 4 to 12 hours, or 12 to 24 hours, and that payment rates then be able to be adjusted to accommodate the specific level of supervision that is required under Assisted Living Plus. So those are the components of how we're trying to become more knowledgeable and help the consumer with this growing product.
Assistant Commissioner, we would like a breakdown of the funding that's required for the survey versus, the study versus the website. And then I'd like to know who's doing the assessments or the consultations that are paid for in this request.
Madam Chair, this would be similar to the long-term care consultation that is currently in existence, and it would be conducted by county staff.
And so why can't they do that with why can't they do that with the resources that they get to do the assessment that they're doing already for this individual?
Madam Chair, this would be an additional group of people because these are not individuals who are expressing a need to move into a nursing facility. This is targeting an additional group of individuals who are looking at assisted living. And so they may not be aware of this group of people because they haven't haven't knocked on the door of the nursing home in order to trigger an assessment.
But I thought a few years ago we changed that so that you would get an assessment if you just had two activities of daily living that were a problem for you.
Madam Chair, you can always request an assessment, but this would require the county to be notified of this group of consumers, so we would expect an increase in the number of people receiving an assessment. Let me also note that this would apply to those who are paying privately, so that it is an expanding group. We now have...
Do we know, Assistant Commissioner, how many of those people currently are assessed as compared to the pool of potential people to be assessed?
Madam Chair, I don't have that level of detail, but we can get you the background on how we develop the funding request for the long-term care consultation.
I appreciate that. Are there any questions on this page? Let's keep moving then.
The next proposal can be found on page 178. We are recommending that we apply waiver provider standards required under the mental retardation or related conditions waiver to similar services in several other waivers, the community alternative care, community alternatives for disabled individuals, and the traumatic brain injury waivers. The intent is to ensure the health and safety of all of our participants in the waiver programs and create a common compliance standard for the providers. In recent years, both the federal and state policymakers have been focusing on strengthening the integrity of the home and community-based waiver programs. The CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have recently established quality assurance guidelines. So we have more information from our partner on what they expect to see. We're also required to report annually what the efforts on behalf of the state are to assure compliance with those standards. Currently, we don't have consistent standards. They are applied to the providers who are serving customers in the MRRC program, but not the other ones. Now, that should not be interpreted that you would meet the standards in the same way. We're not trying to suggest that providers treat all people with similar interventions. But the fact that there aren't existing standards and compliance in the other programs is of concern to us. Additionally, I want to note that this does not this is not a new topic to many of the providers that would be impacted. In the let me give you a couple examples. In the day programs, TBI structured day program, adult daycare, pre-vocational service. There are a total of 172 existing providers. There are only 35 of that group who are not currently needing to meet standards under the MRRC waiver. So they're familiar with the standards. They would just simply, and I don't mean simply, they would need to apply the same kind of policy development, training, and monitoring for the other program participants that they're serving in the other waivers. In the crisis services, there's a total of 253 licensed providers. This would be a new component that their organization would need to adapt to for about 113 of those 253. So it's a fairly well-known component of conducting business in Minnesota. Obtaining what's known as a 245B license is something that we are proposing to apply to all of the providers of service under the waivers that I've mentioned. I will also note that because of the processing of the license applications and the monitoring thereof to make sure that they're doing what they say they're doing, there is a request for an additional 6 FTEs in the licensing division to be able to meet that obligation.
Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, could you just tell us how much the licensing fee is in this area, because the page we have doesn't tell us that?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. It's based on a formula, and we'll have to get that to you. It's size and number of people that they're serving.
Okay. And then maybe also we're trying to figure out why the FFP is so small, and the number is so small here. And maybe you could get that information to us also.
We would be happy to do so.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, let me see if I understood what you were saying. So are you asking that all of the providers that are listed here need to be licensed under 245B?
Madam Chair, Senator Sullivan, that's correct.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, are any of them currently licensed under 245B?
It says approximately 65% are.
Of each category or just certain providers types?
Well, of the group.
Of the total.
Maybe my specific question is about the Center for Independent Living Skills that has, I think, like three facilities throughout the state. And apparently they have been able to provide services under continuing care grants in the past, and this year we're notified that they could no longer do that. And so they're in a quandary, and they provide some of the only independent living skills that are available to the clients that need them. And so the question is, how complicated is that? How complex is it for them to qualify under this 245B license?
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, the standards or the licensing proposal could apply. That would be an option that they would have to be able to continue to contract directly as a provider. So this does solve that recent development with our waiver programs. I'm not going to attempt to address how complicated it is for them. I would suggest that much of what is required under the licensing standards is good practice, and they are probably already doing so. There may be some additional administrative development and oversight that would be required of them, but the page also addresses that there are some costs to providers that are new, and rate adjustments would be available to help them meet the new standards.
And so could we also then get a breakdown of how much of this request is for the rate adjustments and how much is to offset the licensing fee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions on this page? Senator Lynch.
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner. As I'm listening to the presentation today, in the back of my mind, I'm remembering so much of our conversations leading up to this point have been in terms of healthcare reform and getting a handle, particularly on administrative costs. And I can't help but notice that there are a number of provisions in this budget that seem to be have a direct correlation to increased administrative cost.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to jump in, too. I think this obviously is a topic that we're all very deeply concerned about, and I'd like to just echo a few things around the table that have been talked about. Many of us do come from the rural areas, again, and I would like to point out what Senator Berglund said earlier. As we're trying to move from many nursing homes to home and community-based services, Senator Berglund pointed out some of the challenges that home and community-based service providers are looking at right now. And from what I hear back in our communities are that we have people that are trying to serve the elderly here. And I agree with Senator Rosen that this, if you go into long-term care and you're a direct care provider, or whether it's home and community-based options groups, you're there because you care and you want to be doing this work. And it seems like we are not getting the support to the nursing homes and the community-based providers that they need to meet a level of care. It's a quality of care issue. And at the same time, the state is putting more money into the policing end of it. And, you know, like Senator Lynch said, you have six new FTEs coming. We're talking about a whole new level of licensing, a layer. And everyone wants good quality care for our senior citizens. The people that are working in those nursing homes and in those community-based homes are there because they care about these people. And it seems to me there's a huge disarticulation between the policing end of this and the provider end of it. And We're putting more money into raising standards and expecting licensing and more money in administration on this end when the people serving the elderly are in such desperate need. So it just seems to me to be just a huge disconnect between the real world out there beyond, you know, the Capitol and beyond maybe the department. What we're seeing is the in the trenches work that's going on, and they're suffering out there.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, there are thousands of caregivers who are certainly trying to do their very best every day. Mm-hmm. And elderly and people with disabilities are depending upon them to do so. This page, though, does illustrate the transition that is going on from an institutional-based system to a community-based system. We have, whether you want to call it policing, we have quality assurance regulatory oversight on the institutional level that may not be perfect and certainly is always subject to further discussion about how good a job it is doing or not doing, and it depends upon the eye of the beholder. We hear from some consumers that the regulatory oversight should be even stronger than it currently is. And certainly we hear from providers of instances where it is measuring the wrong things. On the home and community-based side, though, we don't have a similar set of tools. We don't have a similar system developed yet to assure the health and safety of the individuals that are receiving services in those alternative settings. And we have, along with the federal government, some obligations to make sure that there are standards in place, that there are certain components to the program that the organization has consciously and purposefully developed policies and practices and meet a certain standard. As with a lot of these types of programs, the far majority of providers and caregivers will do the right thing each and every day. But there is always an example of someone not. And licensing is a tool by which to kind of sort out and have the authority to take action against those very few providers who aren't focusing on the needs of the consumer. This is really in the best interest of the, in this particular page, the 13,500 individuals who are receiving individuals, receiving services in these waiver programs that don't have that protection.
Okay, can we move on?
The next proposal can be found on page 197. As we talked about yesterday, Minnesota can be quite proud of the efforts on behalf of deaf and hard of hearing individuals and deaf-blind individuals. We talked about some of our measurements. We talked about some of the programs that are managed through deaf and hard of hearing services. This proposal, though, recognizes that there is a an additional set of consumers out there that are not served, and these are deaf-blind individuals, both children and adults who have a dual sensory loss. So this proposal would provide funding that would invest in additional training for counties, because that's really where a lot of the point in contact is with the consumers. So that they're familiar with all of the programs that are available, as well as direct service to deaf-blind children and adults who wish to either remain in the community or move into the community. The nature of working with children who are deaf-blind is kind of a moment in time. That moment of learning has to be very specific, very timely, very focused. It can't be put off for next year or whenever. So this provides additional what's called interveners who can work with the deafblind child and the family so that they can develop skills lifelong and early age better than if they didn't have this service available. We also know that without this type of intervention, this type of program, deafblind children are more likely to need additional public support as they become adults. Additionally, we have, so this would provide this service to an additional 25 children and their families. Additionally, we have people who are either living in institutions or are at risk of institution, adults who are living or who want to live in the community that need some direct services. It might be additional help with grocery shopping, with banking services, with other kinds of activities that we kind of take for granted that is quite challenging for people who have a dual sensory loss and are deaf and blind. Another component of the proposal is to let's get my notes here to provide interpreter services, American Sign Language interpreter services to all consumers who are receiving services through the provider, the healthcare community, et cetera, that we are not currently funding. So there's a small investment in allowing providers to be able to bill for that service under medical assistance. We are also, I will note, requesting two staff members to work on this initiative with the enhanced training for counties and the enhanced support to the deafblind clients.
Are there questions about this page? If not, then let's keep moving on.
Next page can be found on, or next proposal can be found on page 211. Similarly, we talked yesterday about the various funding streams for the HIV/AIDS programs in Minnesota. This proposal is specific to the insurance program. The governor recommends that we increase the state budget for the HIV/AIDS insurance program and additionally move this activity into the healthcare access fund. The current insurance support program serves approximately 565 people, again, where we're helping people to continue or obtain insurance for their medical needs. The insurance component of this program has run a continuous deficit for the last several years. We've had a pronged approach to try to manage within the resources available, such as I indicated yesterday, the cost sharing and participant contributions to the program. Additionally, we have been more aggressive in pursuing rebates from the pharmaceutical companies that are providing very specific medications for this disease. With this additional funding, we would be able to serve the anticipated growth in the program. As I indicated yesterday, we are seeing people living longer with AIDS and entering the program at an earlier age. And so, again, as a cost-effective measure, to be able to continue the insurance support for individuals with HIV/AIDS.
Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Coleman, So what is the rationale for refinancing this program out of the Healthcare Access Fund? The Healthcare Access Fund was set up to provide access to uninsured people that were not taken care of by the general fund budget in the past. And so I don't understand why we would refinance this program at this particular point in time.
Madam Chair, we think it fits with a healthcare agenda, helping people access medical care, drugs, et cetera. And it's consistent with always looking for
more money to spend in the general fund on other items other than providing health care access.
Well, Madam Chair, this helps people continue to get access to health care.
Well, you could say that of the medical assistance program, too, but we don't finance the medical assistance program with the health care access fund dollars. Say that of the general assistance medical care program, but we don't finance the general assistance medical care program with health care access fund dollars. The purpose of the fund and the reason for the tax was to create access for people who otherwise are uninsured, right, and do not have access to any of our existing programs. We have an existing program here. Are there any other questions about this page?
The last proposal that I'll present today can be found on page 217. As you're aware, we have a nursing facility report card currently in existence. There are a limited number of facilities in Minnesota who are currently not participating in the nursing facility report card program. They would include the veterans homes as well as those facilities who do not participate in medical assistance. This proposal would allow those facilities to submit the data to the Department of Health and to us, the statistical data, to be included in the report card and allow funding for participating in the quality of life satisfaction surveys that apply to the other almost 400 facilities in the state. So this is intended to provide consumers with a full array of information about all facilities, nursing facilities in Minnesota.
So I'm not sure I quite understand why this would have a general fund impact.
Madam Chair, the major component of this is the quality of life surveys where we contract for staff to go out to facilities and actually conduct face-to-face interviews with consumers.
And so why should the general fund pay for this? Why should not the facilities that might want to be a part of this report card who are not in the medical assistance program pay for it?
Madam Chair, the general fund pays for the current assessment or quality of life program that applies to the other facilities. So this is applying the similar approach or the similar standard to these 11 facilities.
Are there any other questions on this page? Let's move on then.
That concludes the pages that I present.
Any other questions for Assistant Commissioner Coleman? Thank you very much. Then we're going to move on to the healthcare division with Brian Osberg and Scott Leitz. We do have session today at 11, so I'd like to adjourn this meeting about, you know, 5 minutes to, so people have time to get to the chamber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services. And we do have a handout we'd like to take you through. The budget page is in 116, but we're going to take you through a presentation here that will introduce you to the Healthy Connections proposal that the governor is making around health care access. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with me is Scott Leitz, the Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Health, and he will begin the presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about the governor's proposal entitled Healthy Connections. We do have a presentation that we'll walk you through that relate to the Healthy Connections proposal. But the three main reasons that the governor has proposed this program really relate to unsustainable healthcare cost growth, the fact that health insurance premiums and healthcare costs have been growing more rapidly both in the private sector and our public sector programs than have wages or personal income for individuals, that our overall healthcare system right now rewards volume, that is, the number of services that are provided over value, that we aren't necessarily getting the best outcomes for the dollars that we're spending in our healthcare system. And then related to the first point around unsustainable healthcare cost growth is the fact that that's making health insurance coverage increasingly unaffordable for individuals in the marketplace. Because of those three driving needs for health reform, the governor's reform proposal has five main goals. The first is to restructure Minnesota Care Program in a way that's more modern and focused on healthcare outcomes, to increase affordable access to coverage for children in Minnesota, to realign the coverage that is available for individuals as well as incentives in our healthcare system to focus on quality of care and the value of the services that we're receiving, to expand options in the private sector by providing opportunities for individuals to use tax savings and greater choice of plans for individuals and for employees working for small businesses. And then finally, to streamline the administrative burden for small employers who are offering or may be considering offering health insurance coverage. There are really three main elements to the reform proposal, to the Healthy Connections reform proposal. The first is to modernize and improve affordability of the Minnesota Care Program. The second is to allow and encourage greater use of pre-tax dollars to purchase health insurance coverage. And the third is to make enrollment in insurance easier and more transparent through the establishment of the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. We'll walk through each of those elements, and Assistant Commissioner Osberg will start with the first one around the Minnesota Care Program.
Again, if you look to the graph of modernized Minnesota Care, what we mean by that, there are four critical components. One is to expand access coverage for children by expanding eligibility, and also to improve affordability of health care coverage for children by reducing premiums. The second key element of this is to expand choice for certain Minnesota Care enrollees so they have an opportunity to get even more affordable health care coverage for children. And the third and fourth components is to reward healthy behaviors as well as to promote quality and value. And the next graph, key component of this proposal is to increase eligibility for Minnesota Care coverage to 300% of the federal poverty guideline for children. Today, it's at 275% of FPG, and that's the same with adults. For example, for a family of four, the 300% of the federal poverty guideline is a little over $60,000. Now, this also involves expanding coverage for medical assistance for infants up to age two. We have a program called the State Children's Health Insurance Program. It's a federal program whereby we get 65% federal money for covering people in our programs. Now, as I pointed out last week, that money is used here for parents because we provided coverage to children before the enactment of the SCHIP program. And as Senator Pretner Solem pointed out last week, there is discussion at this point as they consider reauthorization of the SCHIP program, whether or not money will be available for parents, and we're certainly watching that carefully. But one of the critical aspects of the SCHIP program is that making sure that infants have coverage that exceeds coverage for other children. That's why today our coverage for infants up to age 2 in medical assistance is 280% of the federal poverty guideline, so we're going to bring it up to 305% of the federal poverty guideline. And the next graph lays out other components of this. One is to reduce future 8% to repeal the 8% Minnesota Care premium increase. This increase went into effect 2 years ago, and the federal government has approved this increase for those people over 200% of the federal poverty guideline. Now, that has not gone into effect yet. That is scheduled to go into effect July of this year. So we're proposing that before that happens, we repeal that 8% increase. We also want to restructure the way Minnesota Care premiums are charged for children. Today, and I'll go over this to the graphs, today premiums are set by for each individual, regardless of age. And a family would pay premiums for adults and premiums under a reduced scale for children, up to 3 children per family. That's how we would structure this going forward. Today we have, again, well, I'll go over the next graph with you. Again, we have, under the current Minnesota Care arrangement, we have one premium structure, notwithstanding a person's age. And then under the restructured premium arrangement, we would have the children's premium would be one-third of the adult premium. And so that'd be obviously significant savings for children under Minnesota Care. Now, under the next graph, we're also introducing a new arrangement, a new option for people in Minnesota Care. It's called Minnesota Care 2, whereby it's subsidized private coverage. We're going to introduce you later to this notion of a health insurance exchange, where people buying individual coverage in the state can go to the exchange and get a set of options available to them, including people in Minnesota Care. This way, people in Minnesota Care, again, for people over 200% of the federal poverty guideline, will be able to have, for children, be able to purchase a lower cost option. Let me take you to the next graph, whereby with this option, then you can see we would have not only reduced premiums for children under Minnesota Care, the regular Minnesota Care, but under Minnesota Care 2, again, available through this exchange, the premiums would be a half again. So it would be one-sixth of the adult premium rate. And let's take you through an example, Minnesota Care family of 4. We have 2 adults and 2 children. For 225% of poverty, annual income is $45,000 for the family income. Now, under the current Minnesota Care premium, it would be $316 per month, because under the current scale, you have $105 for one person, $211 for 2, and $316 for 3 or more. We cap it at that level. Now, if the 8% increase went into effect, which, again, we are suggesting that we repeal that, if that went into effect in July, it would bring up that premium to $341 a month. Now, under the new, under this proposal, the structure for premiums would be as follows. Family premium would be about $295, again, for this family of 4, but 2 adults and 2 children, because you can see the calculation in terms of savings. The 2 adults would be charged $211, and children would be charged $42 each. So the total cost would be $295. Now, we're also going to suggest later on that available to Minnesota Care enrollees will be what's called Section 125, whereby pre-tax dollars could be used to purchase Minnesota Care coverage. So the premiums that are paid by Minnesota Care enrollees, well, they can use pre-tax dollars like you and I can use pre-tax dollars when we buy our insurance. And Commissioner Leitz will take you through that in a little more detail. So not only will there be reduced premium for children under this new structure, but also there will be ability to reduce their costs by applying pre-tax dollars in paying for their premiums. you look at the next graph, again, under Minnesota Care 2, there would be additional savings, whereby the family premium under this case, again, for two adults and two children, would be $253 per month. And the savings under would be $63 per month for this family under Minnesota Care 2. Now, Minnesota Care 2 has a different benefit structure, and I'll go through that in a minute. Now, the second key component to this is obviously to make available to families between 200 and 300% of poverty for their kids this option. And this also provides incentives to consider cost and quality provisions. And I'll take you through that in a second. So expanding enrollee choice, meaning, as I said, this Minnesota Care 2 product will be made available through the exchange. Now, at this point, we're modeling out what that benefit structure would look like. We're modeling out that it would be a deductible of somewhere between $300 and $500 per child under this arrangement. Now, for that, the premium would be half as much, as I said earlier. Now, hopefully we will get federal reimbursement, federal match for this Minnesota Care 2 arrangement. We expect to get federal match for the proposals I mentioned before, expanding up to 300% of FPG. But we also hope to get federal match for this Minnesota Care 2 arrangement. It's not so clear yet as to whether or not they will allow that. There's been some changes under the federal law as to under what conditions will federal money be available for some of our programs. But at this point, we don't assume that there will be federal match for this Minnesota Care 2 product. If I take you then through the next item, the next graph, all health plans with more than 3% of the individual market would be required to offer the Minnesota Care 2 standard plan. There's four such plans today. Again, we're looking at making this available through the private market. Right now, under Minnesota Care arrangement, what we do is contract with 9 managed care organizations. And those 9 managed care organizations are either county-based purchasing arrangements or health maintenance organizations, nonprofit HMOs. And the nonprofit HMOs are required by law to participate in our program. This would allow private insurance plans to, if you will, compete for enrollment for children in Minnesota Care 2, this new arrangement. Now, there may be more than those four. Those four are Medica, Blue Cross, Health Partners, and Fortis. There may be more than those four that participate in this. In fact, also, these plans can offer alternatives, which are called actuarially equivalent alternatives to the standard benefit set, so that people in Minnesota Care 2 can look at other arrangements that would maybe their deductible or their co-payments would be different. So this gives the opportunity for certain Minnesota Care enrollees to really select from a series of what we would call private insurance products. Now, these plans can also offer these arrangements to adults. Now, adults will not enroll in Minnesota Care 2. It's just for children. But adults could enroll in Minnesota Care 2 if they don't otherwise have a subsidy in Minnesota Care. If they want to enroll in the same plan as their children, they can do that. If the children are eligible for coverage, and they may not be eligible for a subsidy, and they may not be. So Minnesota Care 2, again, is structured just for children at this point, not for adults. Now, also in the next page, we're rewarding healthy behaviors and promoting quality and value by doing the following. We want to, and we'll go over this in our budget page in terms of expanding our payment for performance arrangement for providers. We also want to make available to enrollees the opportunity to be rewarded for doing the right thing. And that will be a premium reduction equal to $3 per month per child. And the reason that's set to $3 is because today, this is for all Minnesota Care enrollees, not just for Minnesota Care 2 children. All Minnesota Care enrollees will have the opportunity to get a reduction in their premium if they meet what we call the Q-Care goals. And the Q-Care initiative was announced by the governor last year in conjunction with legislators and other leaders in the healthcare field to provide incentives and ability to improve the access to preventive services as well as to promote good outcomes around diabetes and cardiovascular services. And so as part of that acute care initiative, we want to do is also reward enrollees to do the right thing in terms of seeking healthy behavior. And this includes for children, include, of course, the parents getting their kids immunized as well as getting their kids a well child visit. That's what's involved in these preventive goals. There's going to be a $3 per month incentive for adults who meet the acute care goals around diabetes and cardiac care. And I'll talk more about that when I get to the budget page relating to expanding our payment for performance for providers around diabetic care and cardiac services. There's going to be a maximum of $15 premium reduction. Again, this is under the classic, what we call the classic Minnesota Care, the regular Minnesota Care program. On Minnesota Care, too, there even be additional incentives. Again, a $50 annual bonus for up to three children who do receive those preventive services. And this can help offset their deductible or other costs. And this can carry forward from year to year. This can carry forward. If they didn't use that, they can carry it forward. Now, this is not Minnesota Care 2 arrangement is not an HSA or a flexible account. This is not a that's not what this is. This is a
high deductible.
Well, it's right, Madam Chair. You're right. The current Minnesota Care arrangement does not have a deductible.
Right, because we never felt like the people in the program could afford it.
Well, Madam Chair, what the people in the program are facing now, however, is premiums that are going up to 9.8% of their income. And so
right,
what we're wanting to do.
Those were concessions that we had to make in the past, but we don't have to make them today. So we would propose lowering those premiums also. It doesn't require a high deductible in order to lower premiums.
Madam Chair, we believe that some options available to those people in the higher income scale of Minnesota Care, including having a deductible, would be appropriate because that is one way for us to provide that additional coverage at a lower cost for children. And so we think that those kind of options, if you will, private sector options, would be beneficial to that population. I would agree that for those people under 200% of federal poverty guideline, it probably would not be appropriate. For those who are paying a higher premium now in Minnesota Care, we think we need to develop some options at lower costs, especially for children.
So what is the deductible that's being proposed here?
Madam Chair, the health information, health insurance exchange will actually develop the final benefit structure, but what we're modeling is $300 to $500 deductible per child, up to maximum of three children.
So what is the income for a family of four with
income for a family
three children?
Income of a family of four
at 200%.
At 200%?
Maybe.
At 300% is $60,000. At 200%, it's $40,000. Is my quick math.
40 to 60.
Yes, so it would be about $40,000 for a family of four at 200% of the federal poverty guideline.
So that could mean a $1,500 deductible for that family with three children.
Well, it would mean, yes, Madam Chair, it would mean a $1,500 deductible total for the family, and that is true. Now, that just like Madam
plus
Chair,
the premiums and plus whatever the co-payments would be.
And the premiums would be half of what the premiums would be under regular Minnesota Care.
Let's go on. We'll probably not get through this today, folks, so we'll have to probably reschedule. So let's let them just go through it, and I'll try to control myself.
Madam Chair, turn over to Commissioner Leitz to discuss the next component of this proposal.
Madam Chair, members, the second component of the proposal really focuses on improving the affordability of the private insurance market in Minnesota. The second element is to improve that affordability and accessibility of health coverage for those enrolling in private insurance as well as through the Minnesota Care 2 program that Assistant Commissioner Osberg described. The first element is to allow and encourage greater use of pre-tax dollars for individuals buying health insurance coverage in Minnesota, whether they're purchasing that through the private market or whether they're purchasing that through Minnesota Care. Today, those of us who enjoy access to employer-sponsored coverage do so with pre-tax dollars. That's how we purchase the coverage that our employer offers to us. However, persons who purchase outside a group do not have the same ability to use pre-tax funds to purchase coverage. And so the second part of the proposal seeks to expand the ability of employees of businesses who do not offer coverage to use pre-tax dollars to purchase insurance coverage. The plan does this by requiring that employers with 10 or more employees establish what are called Section 125 plans. Section 125 refers to the section of the IRS tax code that allows individuals to use pre-tax dollars to purchase health insurance coverage. Again, that would include the purchase of, for example, a Minnesota Care policy where a premium is involved. The plan doesn't require that insurers offer coverage, nor does it require that employers offer coverage, nor does it require that employers contribute towards the cost of coverage, but it does allow individuals who are working for employers who don't offer health insurance coverage to put away dollars into that, put away their premium dollars pre-tax so that they can use those pre-tax dollars to purchase health insurance coverage. We think that this will give individuals some greater ability to have some savings when they purchase their coverage, whether they're purchasing a public insurance policy where a premium is involved, such as Minnesota Care, or whether they're purchasing in the individual insurance market. On the employer end, we estimate that the cost of setting up a Section 125 plan under this requirement would be about $300. The ongoing costs of keeping that plan in place are lower than that. And employers do realize some savings because dollars that are put in pre-tax by their employees are not subject to certain taxes that the employer would otherwise have to pay. And so once an employer has approximately two or more on average of employees taking advantage of the Section 125 plans, that initial cost is essentially made up by the reduced tax liability that the employer faces. The employer would then have to, once those Section 125 plans are established, designate the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, which I'll get to in just a moment, as that employer's insurer. And then individuals who work for that employer who now does not offer health insurance coverage would be able to use those pre-tax dollars that are being withdrawn or were being withheld from their paycheck, transferred to the exchange, and then the exchange would make payments on behalf of those individuals for the health insurance coverage that they're choosing to enroll in. How much would this save? We have a few examples that we've put into the presentation. The first looks at a single parent with two children. And it looks at it over a variety of income spectrums ranging from $30,000 to $70,000. What you see is at the $30,000 levels, the savings is substantial, around 60% of the cost of the premium. The reason that's so high at that income level is because dollars that are being withheld used pre-tax, for example, or that are not taxable, also don't count towards eligibility for the working family tax credit or the federal earned income tax credit. And so more individuals then become eligible for that tax credit because those dollars that are being withheld pre-tax are not counted as income towards establishing eligibility for those programs. And so if you count sort of the effect of the EITC, the WFC, as well as the taxes that individuals would not be paying tax on, the flat taxes, payroll, the FICA taxes, as well as federal and state income taxes, the savings is actually substantial at that $30,000 level. Now, the working family tax credit and the earned income tax credit phase out as income gets higher, and so you can see as income goes up that the benefit ranges anywhere from 30 to 40%. Again, those are primarily federal income tax, state income tax, as well as the flat taxes that every individual pays, and they would not now be subject to for any dollars that they put away pre-tax. We go through a couple of other examples in here, which I won't walk through, but the savings are similar, somewhat higher at lower level.
If I can just interrupt you, what on this graph was assumed to be the premium cost, since we're talking about percentage of premium cost?
Madam Chair, the premium cost was assumed to be a private sector insurance premium for the number of people who are an individual market insurance policy with a $500 deductible for the number of people who are listed. So in this case, it would be a single parent with two children. So it was assumed to be that average cost in the market.
And what is that?
Do you remember, April? I don't.
Madam Chair, roughly $3,000.
A year.
And Madam Chair, this would also be made available to Minnesota Care enrollees. Of course, they have a much lower premium that they have to contribute. So the Minnesota Care enrollees would also be able to take advantage of this pre-tax arrangement.
Madam Chair, a clarifying point that staff indicated is that at the lower income levels, for those below 275 of poverty, we assume that the premium was a Minnesota Care premium that was being taught worked with. So the premium that they would pay on the Minnesota Care program is what was being used as the percentage savings.
Well, now I'm totally confused. Is the $30,000 family being assumed to be paying a Minnesota Care premium or a $3,000 premium?
Madam Chair, the lower income family is assumed to be paying a Minnesota Care premium.
Well, then this chart is pretty hard to compare. I mean, it's pretty hard to compare the $30,000 income person then to the $70,000 income person, because we're not comparing against the same thing.
Madam Chair, we certainly make that information available to you. That will be consistent across the chart. I think the main point is that there is substantial savings at across income spectrums. Even if you were to compare that savings relative to a private market policy, the savings would be relatively substantial compared to current.
Right. And the other point that I just like to make, because I don't know, sometimes I think the way we use our language is important. This isn't actually reducing any healthcare spending. This isn't actually reducing premium. What it is doing is taking money that otherwise would be going into the tax system to pay for services and making it available for people to use it for healthcare instead.
Madam Chair, that's accurate. This does not reduce premiums. We believe it improves the affordability of premiums for individuals because it lowers their actual out-of-pocket cost towards those premiums. But you're correct. It does not reduce the premiums.
Right. And so it does not reduce healthcare spending.
Madam Chair, nothing in this particular aspect of the proposal, the use of the Section 125 plans, does that.
I just want to be clear, because when we talk about savings, sometimes people think savings means a reduction in actual cost.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I think we want to be transparent and clear that this proposal is intended to improve affordability. This aspect of it is not intended necessarily to lower overall health care spending in the state. A point, though, that I think is important to make is that most of the benefit that we do receive here is a federal benefit. About $4 of federal benefit for every dollar of cost. There is some state cost involved here because of the reduction in revenue that occurs when people have certain amounts of their income which isn't taxed. And so for every dollar that we do lose in revenue at the state level, there's about $4 of that comes in from the federal government. So that I just wanted to make that point.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to clarify this chart that I didn't understand, and I still don't understand.
Madam Chair, we'll try to get one that's more understandable. Thank you. Madam Chair, the last element of the proposal really ties to the Section 125 plan proposal, and that is the we propose to establish the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. The Health Insurance Exchange is intended to be a nonprofit organization that would perform a number of functions in the marketplace. Its overall intention is to improve access and affordability for health insurance coverage for people who don't have access to coverage through an employer. We think that it will increase the transparency and functioning of the individual insurance market. We also believe that it has an opportunity to simplify and streamline some of the administrative difficulties that small employers face in offering health insurance coverage, as well as promote portability of health insurance coverage beyond what's currently available to people who do not have access to employer-based coverage. Again, the exchange will be is intended to be established as a nonprofit entity that would be governed by a board of directors. It would have a number of functions in the marketplace. The first is to help employers establish the Section 125 plans that are required under the proposal. In addition, one of the things that we do know right now is that the individual insurance market can be a challenge for people to shop in. If you're purchasing coverage outside of a group, you don't always know what options are available to you. There's no single place to go to get that information as there is if you're working for an employer and you go to your human resources department. They tell you kind of what's available. In a sense, the exchange would play that human resources function for individuals who don't have insurance coverage through a group. We would have all of the individual and market operate through the exchange so that all the choices are available to the individual at the time that they choose to enroll. And we believe that the exchange would be able to provide then a transparent and a comparative shopping for individuals who are purchasing or shopping for individual insurance plans in Minnesota. It would assist people to enroll in those plans that are offered through the exchange. And then it would also receive those Section 125 pre-tax payments from health insurance premiums from the employers and make premium payments to the health plans on behalf of the individuals who are enrolling. So you can think about it as I'm an individual now who works for an employer who doesn't offer health insurance coverage. That employer sets up a 125 plan under our requirement. I would have dollars for my individual insurance plan withheld each month, just as we do now if you're employed. Dollars are withheld from your paycheck. Those dollars go to the exchange. The exchange makes payments on your behalf to the insurer for the insurance coverage you receive. It would also receive subsidy payments from the state for people enrolled in the Minnesota Care 2 program and pass those along through to the health plans. And then it would also have responsibility, finally, for administering the bonus accounts and premium reductions for Minnesota Care enrollees meeting their Q Care targets that Assistant Commissioner Osberg described earlier. Madam Chair, the proposal overall, in terms of its impact, we estimate that the total new enrollment in Minnesota Care as a result of the proposal is estimated at around 15,000 children and 1,200 adults by 2011. We also estimate that over 40,000 additional people will be able to receive a benefit that they're not currently through the expanded use of the Section 125 plans. That is the ability to purchase coverage with a pre-tax dollar that they're not currently doing. And then we believe that everybody who buys coverage in the individual market or through the MCHA program will also benefit from the exchange in the sense that they will have easier and better and more transparent shopping for the policies that they do choose to purchase. In terms of cost, we have listed out what the main elements of the proposal are in terms of the expenditures required. The first line for human services really relates to the Minnesota Care aspects of the proposal that Commissioner Osberg described. We have listed also the startup costs for the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. There would also be the ongoing costs in the out biennium are zeroed out because we are proposing to have the exchange be a self-sustaining entity where an assessment on the plans that are sold through the exchange would actually pay for the ongoing costs of the exchange. We estimate that to be about 0.5% of premium. And then, as I mentioned, there is a modest revenue impact because of the dollars that are now being shielded from taxes that are going in pre-tax for state income tax, for example. There is some cost to the state general fund as a result of that. So in summary, what the Healthy Connections proposal really intends to do and seeks to do is expand coverage to more children in our state, as well as expanding choices in the Minnesota Care program to improve the affordability of both public and private coverage by reducing Minnesota Care premiums for children and allowing more individuals to take advantage of tax savings, to more transparently create the individual and make the individual insurance market function better by making that marketplace a more transparent and understandable market for individuals through the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, and then to reward healthy behaviors, really focusing, again, on quality and value and not just the volumes of services that are being provided. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Leitz, can we get a breakdown of how many of the children are affected by the premium reductions, how many are affected by the premium reductions in Minnesota Care, how many are affected by the increased eligibility standard, and how many are affected by this insurance exchange itself.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I do notice on your first slide on the last page here that most of the people that are impacted by this Section 125 benefit are already insured people.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We think about an additional 41,000 will be new, but there's also going to be a group that would not be new.
So how many are you thinking will be newly insured people as opposed to existing insured people?
Madam Chair, if I remember our estimates correctly, I'm going to ask April Todd Malmlev to give you the answer to the question in terms of the number of new people who are insured.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is April Todd Malmlev. I'm the Assistant Director of the Health Economics Program. And in response to your question about the 41,000, roughly 9,000 of that 41,000 would be uninsured, people that do not currently have coverage. The rest would be people that currently purchase in the individual market or Minnesota Care or the MSHA program.
So one could probably draw a conclusion here then that the majority of the people that would be impacted by this $30.5 million expenditure and the $89.8 million expenditure would be people who are already insured?
There would be a substantial portion that are already insured. We can give you a detailed breakout of what the prior sources of coverage are for all of the people.
Madam Chair, there'd be approximately 25,000 new insured, newly insured, and 32,000 people who would benefit who are already insured.
Right. I understand that, Assistant Commissioner, and what we're trying to get is a breakdown of what parts of the proposal impact what parts of the uninsured versus the insured.
Madam Chair, we can provide that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, I think an important part of that, too, is how is that more affordable, too, through the program for those folks that are insured, how much more affordable are we making that health insurance through this program?
Senator Fischbach, I understand that aspect of this proposal, but again, I would just remind you that the use of Minnesota Care funds was set up and designed specifically to try to help people who are uninsured get coverage.
Well, and Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that if we're asking for additional information, maybe we should see if we can include that information too. What kind of affordability, increased affordability are we going to see?
Well, I think that's
I know there's
what,
a couple of charts,
I think that's
but
what these other slides are trying to do for us. If we can straighten them out so we can understand them, we'll probably have that information. I think it's five of, so I think we're going to stop here. And I know that Assistant Commissioner Osberg cannot be here tomorrow and that the department had anticipated presenting other parts of their budget tomorrow. So I think that we will probably reschedule the balance of this presentation for next Monday. And I'm thinking we probably don't need the whole 2.5 hours, so about how long do you think you need?
Madam Chair, I would say probably 45 minutes to an hour at most to go over my other budget pages. I would say up to about an hour.
All right, so why don't we say